So I want to do a review or just a statement of the main theory of Eisenstein, part of the theory of Eisenstein series that will be used to set up the trace formula before we go back to the geometric side to try to prove the convergence of the integral. So I think it's if there was a vote among mathematicians as one of the more difficult theories to learn, complete theory, in which Eisenstein series in some sense is, it might be Eisenstein series. It's very deep and difficult mathematics. It's due to Langlands. It was originated by Selberg and completed by Langlands. And let me just give you a few references. The main book where Langlands proved the theorems is in Springer Lecture Notes, 544. Everything's there, but it's very, very dense and heavy going. I mean, really, really so. but it's I mean, in some sense, I people have read it and who've had the if they've had well, not so many. But people who've had the patience to go through it in detail have found it actually works pretty, that it's very rewarding. Now, another book, which I'm not familiar with, but some people have found it very good, is it's a larger book in which more the details are, I mean, in which it's done in more detail. Not that the details are lacking from Langlands, but they're just done very sparsely. In Cambridge, I guess it's the Cambridge, but it's by Mugland and Walsberger in the Cambridge University Press, a more recent book. And then there's a couple of, there's a number of survey articles. Perhaps the best to start with is Langlands' article in the Boulder Proceedings, where the main strategy of the proofs, how you sort of where you start off and how you go about proving things is done. And then I have an article which includes basically what I'm going to talk on in the next couple of lectures in the Corvallis Proceedings. Now, why do you need Eisenstein series? Well, you need them because we have a general group G, and you need them because the regular, if it's not a compact quotient, the regular representation R, say maybe R upper G, if we want to vary G, the regular representation of GA1. You have actually sort of two equivalent ways to think of this. You can think of the regular representation of GA1, or you can deal with the regular representation of GA. If you're doing with this, you could take it on L2. You would take it on L2 of GQ mod GA1. If you're dealing with GA and you want a part that decomposes discretely, then you would take L2 of GQ times this central real part to the central torus AG0. The two are equivalent. But in any case, the regular representation of GA on this space does not decompose discretely in general. So in other words, it has a part that does decompose discretely and an orthogonal part that decomposes continuously. And it acts, these two things, acting on two orthogonal invariant subspaces of the relevant Hilbert space, L2 discrete, and L2 continuous. And the purpose of Eisenstein series is to give an explicit spectral resolution of this piece. So the spectral resolution of L2 continuous is given by the theory of Eisenstein series. So just as a general remark, in very elementary terms, but qualitatively, this behaves, because it decomposes discretely, it behaves like the theory of Fourier series, whereas this, because it decomposes continuously, behaves more like the theory of Fourier transforms. As a matter of fact, this of course includes several pieces in each of which there are some discrete parameters as well as some continuous parameters. But as far as the continuous parameters are concerned, it behaves qualitatively like the theory of Fourier transforms. And Eisenstein series themselves can be then regarded simply as they play the role of the functions e to the lambda x, lambda being purely imaginary, x in R, in the theory of Fourier series. I mean the theory of Fourier transforms. So this behaves like qualitatively like Fourier series, and this qualitatively behaves like Fourier transforms. I mean, so in that sense, how do you think of the Fourier transform? You say you have the regular representation of R on L2 of R by translation, and you want to decompose that into a direct integral of irreducible representations. Well, the irreducible representations are the characters. These characters as one-dimensional representations of the additive group of reals. But really, we want to think of this thing, so in other words, you can build another Hilbert space, L2 of lambda, of the lambda variable. This is lambda in IR. We want to think of L2 of the space in the lambda variable, on which the group acts by pointwise multiplication by these representations, e to the lambda x. So that's also a representation of X in R, a so-called direct integral of these irreducible representations. And what the theory of Fourier transforms does, it gives you an explicit unitary isomorphism from the original representation to the space which is explicitly constructed as a direct integral of these representations. And this is the kernel of that unitary isomorphism, a unitary isomorphism, in fact, which intertwines the two actions of R on the two spaces. So that's what you want out of the theory of Eisenstein series. Now, the representations that occur in the direct integral, the explicit sort of representations out of which this would be built, are given by induced representations from parabolic subgroups, standard parabolic subgroups. As we would expect, there's no continuous spectrum in the case of compact quotient, and by the theorem of Borel and Harris-Chandra, that's exactly the case where there are no proper parabolic subgroups. So the continuous spectrum has, therefore, we expect, better have something to do with parabolic subgroups, and indeed it does. So P is a parabolic subgroup. Lambda we would like lambda to be purely imaginary, but we can't get away with just that. the whole construction of these things is based on treating arbitrary characters, lambda, in the whole complex vector space, complexification of AP star. And then what we form is the induced representation Y from P to G, twisted by lambda. Okay, so Y is in G A. So we form let that representation be the induced representation. We could write it as the induced representation from PA up to GA of what representation of PA? It's the representation that is obtained by taking the identity one-dimensional representation of NPA. And on MPA, we take the discrete spectrum, the part of the regular representation of the smaller reductive group, the Levy component MP, that decomposes discretely. So let's use this form of it. So L2 discrete MPQ APR0 MPA. And we would induce this, we want to induce this representation from P up to G. But I want actually a continuous family of induced representations, so I don't take, in general, I don't take this representation, but I twist it by lambda in the way we've described before. So this is the discrete spectrum. MP, and this means twisted by lambda. And so this is the representation induced from PA to GA. And so you set things up so that this representation acts on a Hilbert space. It acts on the Hilbert space of measurable functions phi from. So they're functions on GA, but which transform a certain way under left translation by PA. So they're functions on NP. So in fact, you set it up. You're dealing with the discrete spectrum here. So that's a piece of the regular representation of M of MP. So in fact, you can take MPQ here, since the underlying representation is the discrete spec is the regular representation or part of the regular representation of MPA, which is on MPA modulo MPQ times APR0. Okay, so this is a subgroup, and you would take functions on GA modulo that subgroup, complex-valued functions, such that. Well, you want to ask, you don't want to take literally all functions because you want the M components of such a function to be actually in the discrete spectrum, so that so such that for every X in GA, the function, so two conditions, for every X in GA, you ask that the function for a given phi, you ask that the function phi of mx, okay, x being fixed, but m now being regarded as an element in mp q, mpa, I could either do MPQAPR0 MPA, or I could do this MPQ MPA1, and so such that this function such that this function lies in L2 discrete of MPQ MPA1. In other words, it's just you're not taking all functions, you're only taking the ones that contribute to the induced the representation induced from the discrete spectrum. And then, of course, you want to make it a Hilbert space, so you ask that the natural Hilbert space norm on this, on a given function phi. Well, so remember that the best way to put a norm on this is we remember that GA is equal to PA times K. In other words, it's NMK. So it's invariant under N, and so we'll just ask that this would amount to an integral on a quotient of G, the integral over K, the integral MPQ, MPA1, of B of MK squared, dm dk. We ask that that be finite. So, we have, that's a Hilbert space actually that doesn't depend on lambda. So I'll just remark on that in a minute. But with this Hilbert space, then by definition, the induced representation acts on a vector in that Hilbert space as follows. So IP lambda of y is the operator that takes a given phi and sends it to the new function in the Hilbert space whose value at x is essentially right translation of phi by y, except we haven't put in the twist here into the definition of the Hilbert space, so I have to put it in to the definition of the representation, and what you get is something slightly more complicated. E to the lambda, and again I will say a word about this in a moment, you actually take lambda plus this vector rho p that I mentioned earlier, half the sum of the roots of PA, counting multiplicity, and you evaluate that at HP of x, y. And then you take e to the minus lambda plus rho p HP of x. Okay, so that, I mean, if you're familiar with induced representations, you see that this isn't quite the standard definition for the following reason. We have made the standard definition of an induced representation is you take functions on G and you ask that they transform, that they be equivariant. So typically, an induced representation consists of functions from G into the space on which the representation of the smaller group is acting. Well, we're okay there because I can really regard such a function by I can regard this as a function of M. There's a vector in the space on which this acts. So it really is a function on G which into the vector space on which the smaller representation acts. But you ask you also ask that under the left translation of the underlying group here, that it transform according to the representation. And this doesn't quite do that. We've made it invariant under AP0, but yet we're asking for a twisted representation. So you can either put this lambda into the Hilbert space, and then you'll get a Hilbert space that depends on lambda, which is a little aesthetically not so pleasing, a little harder to work with. Or you can take a Hilbert space, you can identify all the Hilbert spaces as lambda varies with one Hilbert space, this one, but then you better put the lambda, something's got to depend on lambda, so you better put the lambda into the operators on that fixed Hilbert space. So having, let's just say, having made the underlying space HP independent of lambda, then we have to put the twist of lambda so it's this, in fact, it's this operator that would identify the, namely e to the lambda times h of what the underlying vector that would identify the various Hilbert spaces as they vary with lambda with this one Hilbert space. So you have to put then it into the definition. So we have to put the twist by lambda into the formula for IP a lambda of y. And that doesn't explain rho. So rho, it's not, you're not, doesn't look like you're really twisting by lambda. You're really twisting by lambda plus a real vector, something that's not purely imaginary, namely this rho p. And you put that in because so this is a standard convention for induced representations. We remember that this rho is related to the difference between the left Haar measure and the right Haar measure on the non-unimodular group P. So we include the square root e to the rho P H P U as a function, say, of u in PA. So this is actually the square root of the modular function in the definition of any induced representation. Of the non-unimodular group, in other words, a group whose left and right Haar measures are not the same, the non-unimodular group PA. And the reason for doing this is, if you just sort out what's this, of course, doesn't come in to the original context of induced representations, which were the case. Which were invented for finite groups, and of course all unimodular, but the more general induced representations of locally compact groups, it's perhaps wiser to put this in, because what it does is this makes the induced representation unitary, and that's really what we're interested in. Whenever the inducing representation is unitary. And so in this case, we are allowing lambda to be any complex element in the complex vector space, but the twist of this unitary representation by the complex lambda will be unitary precisely when lambda is purely imaginary. And if you don't put that in, then you have the induced representation being unitary whenever lambda belonged to IAP star, I guess, minus rho p. So that's, of course, do it that way, but it's easier, I think, to keep track of things if you just put the rho p in the definition. And then finally, this is all constructed in terms of the discrete spectrum on the Levy subgroup M. So suppose you know about M's a smaller reductive group than G. Of course, you can take it for G itself, but then you're just, by definition, it's the discrete specter. There's nothing induced. It's just if P is equal to G, then it's, of course, just the discrete spectrum of G. But otherwise, M's a smaller group, and suppose that you know something about its discrete decomposition. So suppose that MP discrete has been given to you as a direct sum of irreducible representations so pi an irreducible representation of MPA and let's after all, why are we interested in, ultimately, we're interested in automorphic representations because we're interested in how they decompose as tensor products of irreducible representations of the local constituents, the groups G, Q, V. So, suppose you not only know pi, but you know something about its local components, its tensor product. As an irreducible irreducible representations of the local groups. So pi b being an irreducible representation of m p q v. Well, then it follows formally from this construction that this induced representation, I, P, G, lambda, that this is a direct, of course, a given pi, I'm allowing myself to, I'm not putting multiplicities in here, so I'm allowing myself to repeat pi several times if it occurs with the higher multiplicity than one, but let's with that convention, then IPG lambda is then going to be isomorphic to a direct, the corresponding direct sum over pi of all of the induced representations IP pi lambda, pi twisted by lambda, and so this I mean just this I just mean induced, well, I'll write it down in a minute, but this is, obviously this notation means I take this irreducible representation of M, I inflate it to P by asking it that it be trivial on NPA, and then I induce that. That's a smaller representation, that's inducing a sub-representation from which this representation is given. And then, again, that would be a direct sum over pi, and then each of these, in fact, would be a tensor product over V of induced representations of the local groups, pi V lambda. So I P pi, that's an irreducibly induced representation representation attached to pi from representation induced from the identity representation on NPA times pi and pi v a corresponding induced representation. QV. And this follows because the twist of a tensor product of representations by lambda will be the corresponding tensor product of the twisted representations. And so you just I'm sorry, I'm not it's the it's the okay, so pi v oh, thank you, sorry, ip pi v again is the induced representation. Of GQV from representation induced from the representation by taking the identity representation on NPQV and pi V of the sorry?
Pi V lambda is pi V except
That's right. So pi v and pi v lambda of m v is pi v m v, and you can still form e to the lambda h p m v, even though because m v is contained in the adelic group, and so it's just defined the same way as a twist. And the reason that you get the twists coming into the product, you use the fact that H MP is a homomorphism. E to the lambda H MP of M is just the product over all V. It would, because M is an adelic matrix, almost all of the terms in this product for any given M would be 1. It's the product of e to the lambda h m p m v. That's because h p h is an additive homomorphism. So you raise it to an exponential power, you get a product, and this is for any M with local components m v in MPA. So the little conclusion of this remark 3 is that if you understand the decomposition of the discrete spectrum of MP, the smaller group, so if you understand the decomposition of L to discrete MPQ APR0 MPA, and, okay, so let's suppose we're interested in automorphic representations, and what we're really interested in those is the how an automorphic representation breaks into local constituents. It's the information that parameterizes the local constituents of an automorphic representation, taking these how the information relates to the different constituents of a given automorphic representation. It's that information that is really the heart of why automorphic representations are interesting. So let's say you understand that. A tall order, but let's just assume that we know about the decomposition. If we know something about the decomposition of this, and then we need to know something else, and if also you understand the induced representations, IP pi z lambda of the local groups GQV. You need to know something about that too if you want to know about IP as a representation, IP lambda as a representation of G. You need to know these two things. But let me just point out that this is really an easier problem, although it's by no means trivial. This is really a kind of a central part of what Harish Chandra worked on. So this is a central part. Of work of Harishchandra. Then you understand this, the decomposition of I, P, lambda. So the IP lambda then is to be regarded as something that is known. In principle, I mean inductively, it produces, it's under, we know it if we understand the discrete spectrum of smaller groups. So the theory of Eisenstein series, the goal of that, the aim of the theory, is to, I want to relate these induced representations to L2, the continuous spectrum of GA. Now it doesn't just do, just as I sort of described for the theory of Fourier transforms, it doesn't just do to say, well, maybe L2 continuous is built out of these things, these IP lambdas. That's what you end up showing in the end. But what's really important is not just knowing that, but actually having explicit isomorphisms or explicit intertwining operators between IP lambda, that induced representation, and the continuous spectrum, L2 continuous. They are not irreducible. But this is how they break up into irreducible representations.
For specific capital irreducible representation of the parabolic, then it's induced in the
irreducible. Oh, I see. Okay, so you're going to say that these, even these things might not be irreducible. they're very close to being irreducible if pi is irreducible. In fact, if lambda is in general position, they are irreducible. So we, in the end, it's like the theory of Fourier series, Fourier transforms. Really, the L2 theory, lambda's taken up to set of measure zero. You'll see how we set it up. So for all intents and purposes, at least for discussing the decomposition of a direct integral, you might as well take lambda to be in general position, and then those, in fact, are irreducible. Even for arbitrary lambda, they only have finitely many irreducible components. So there. So what we want, what one wants to do then, is to construct intertwining operators between the representations IP lambda and RG continuous, two representations of GA. That's to say, unitary maps from one Hilbert space into another Hilbert space on, that commute with the action of GA. And it turns out you can't separate this problem with a closely related problem, the problem of when the different representations IP lambda are themselves equivalent. So you need, part of the theory includes having also to construct intertwining operators among the basic representations IP lambda that are supposed to describe the continuous spectrum. So among the representations IP lambda, say, as p and lambda varies. So just, on that second question, there are some natural symmetries among the pairs, or what symmetries turn out to be relevant for this question. The symmetries that are relevant to the question are given as follows. For any pair of standard parabolic subgroups P and P prime, there's a finite set of maps that you can get from the Coxeter group, the finite, the Weyl group attached to G. Let's write W, AP, and AP prime. So those are two real vector spaces attached to P and P prime. And let me write that. It's not a group, it's a set. Let this be the set of isomorphisms from this vector space onto this vector space that you can get, set of all such isomorphisms that you can get by restricting elements in the Weyl group. So the set of distinct linear isomorphisms from, these are both embedded in A0, the space on which the Weyl group acts. So from AP onto AP prime, that you can get by restricting elements in the Weyl group. Regarding the Weyl group as a group of linear transformations on the vector space A0. Now, that set actually for an arbitrary P and P prime, there might not be any. I mean, if the vector space is AP and AP prime don't have the same dimension, you're not going to have any elements in that set. So that set could easily be empty. In the case that G equals GLN, and we identify A0 with Rn, and we identify the Weyl group W with the symmetric group, then we've got two parabolic subgroups P and P prime. So if P corresponds to one partition, N1 up to N, I'll try to write, I guess I've been in the habit of indexing the size of the partition by a little p, so hope this won't be confusing. That's n little p and p prime corresponds to the partition n prime 1, n prime little p prime. Then the set W A P A P prime will be empty unless the two vector spaces have the same dimension, which is to say that little p prime equals little p. And then in that case, the set AP AP prime is then can be identified with a subgroup in the symmetric group on P elements, the set of S in the symmetric group. So for two, if P little p prime is equal to little p, then this can be identified with the set in the symmetric group, such that the ith block, the size of the ith piece of the second partition, ni prime, unless that's the same size as the size of the s, s is the permutation of I, so unless n I prime is equal to n si. And you don't want that for every I. So it's a subgroup of the symmetric group on P elements. So in other words, if you're talking about a parabolic subgroup that's uniform in the sense that it corresponds to a partition all of whose elements are equal, then it's the full, this set can be identified with the full symmetric group. So one would expect, it turns out that it's natural to expect that so we would expect the representations IP prime, lambda prime, and IP lambda to be equivalent if and only if. If and only if, so this set WAP AP prime, that's a set of linear transformations from AP to AP prime. So it could also be identified with a set of linear transformations from their dual, between their dual spaces, a set of linear isomorphisms, in fact, from AP star to AP prime star. And so you'd expect them to be equivalent if and only if lambda prime is equal to lambda, equal to F lambda for some F in W AP AP prime. Okay, so it's the first set of intertwining operators that are the Eisenstein series. So I'm just going to give the formal definition. So we're going to take F. We'll take X to be in GA. We'll take phi to be an element in HP. And we'll take lambda to be in AP C star. All right. I want an intertwining operator under 1. I want an intertwining operator from IP lambda to L2. Actually, L2 continuous. So it's going to be an operator given by an integral kernel. So I want, if it's to be an integral kernel, I mean, both of these spaces have measures on them. They're both Hilbert spaces given by some L2 norm. So I've got I'm looking for an integral kernel from the space on which IP lambda acts into the space on which the regular representation acts. So I would like a function then of two variables. Phi is my variable in the space HP, but it's also going to depend on lambda because it's an intertwining operator, just as in the theory of Fourier transforms, that's e to the lambda x. So this is the variable in the induced representation, characterizing the induced representation, and then I have a variable in the space on L2 continuous, namely x. So it's just like e to the lambda x in the theory of Fourier transforms. It's a function of two variables, except you've got to put this extra variable in because we're dealing with a much more complicated representation, an infinite dimensional induced representation. And so what you do is you take the function phi in this Hilbert space. You are going to have to twist it because we haven't built the lambda into this space, so it's twisted with the rho p, hp. And so I would put x in here, except that function is only left invariant under translation by pq. And, of course, I want something in L2 of GA over GQ. I want left GQ invariant. So we just brutally sum delta in PQ over GQ on the left. It's really a sum over cosets because it's already, that function is already left invariant under translation by PQ. And this is what's called an Eisenstein series. And then the second kind of intertwining operator is a little bit more complicated, but I'll say a word in a moment why it's plausible, or why it's a natural thing to consider. So what I want is now an operator from HP lambda, HP to HP prime for every element S in here. So it's going to be, this is going to be an operator from HP to HP prime. And it'll be the operator that sends a vector phi in the first space, HP, to a vector in the second space, HP prime, whose value at x is, well, you're basically doing the same kind of thing. You are brutally taking a function, say, that's left invariant, namely phi, left invariant under NPQ, under NPA, and you're trying to make it left invariant under NP prime A. So you simply integrate, you take your function phi, so the definition is a little more complicated, you take your function phi of x. I'll just write the definition down and say a word about it in a minute. So you take ws to the minus 1, so I'll say in a moment, ws is actually a representative of s in the group GQ, and then I integrate over n. And n is to be in np prime of a, the new unipotent radical under which I want to make this left invariant. But just like here, there's already some, as a function of n, there's already some left invariance of this. And what is it? It's the intersection of np prime with the conjugate of the original group, npa by s. So it's ws, npa, ws to the minus 1. I'm integrating over that coset. So this is not a difficult kind of a group. It's a unipotent group as a space. It's just a bunch of additive groups. It's just a bunch of adels, and this is a subset of a bunch of copies of the adel. So as the group theory structure is a little more complicated here because it's a unipotent group, but as a space, it's just a bunch of adels. And in fact, the Haar measure on a unipotent group is the same as the Haar measure on the corresponding Euclidean measures attached to the various adels. So it's really, the space you're integrating over isn't terribly bad, but then we have to put the twists in. So we have to put e to the lambda plus rho p hp ws to the minus 1 n x, and I have to put the twist. You wouldn't have these at all if now you were letting the space HP depend on lambda, but then you have an e to the minus rho p, e to the minus s lambda plus rho p prime of HP prime x. And this is integrated against n. And this is for any this is for any s in W AP AP prime, and with a representative WS in GQ, so WS is a point in GQ, under the isomorphism. So again, this is something that we haven't mentioned before, but the Weyl group really has two ways, it appears, and of course it's a theorem to show that the two ways are the same. It's the finite group generated by reflections about the roots in the root system, but then as a group of operators on the maximal torus in the given Lie group, or in this case the maximal split torus A0, it is isomorphic. It's isomorphic, in fact, to the normalizer of in GQ of that split torus modulo the centralizer in GQ of that split torus, and this in fact being equal to M0 of Q. In any case, the action of the Weyl group on the torus A0 in fact comes by conjugation of elements in the group. That's kind of like a basic theorem in Lie groups and Lie algebras relating the Weyl group attached to the root system with, in fact, group of transformations of a maximal torus. Now, these formulas might look a little, especially this one, this is always one that seems problematic, well, not problematical, but it just looks like a rather complicated formula. It wouldn't be nearly so complicated if I had my space HP varying with lambda. Then you wouldn't have this at all. You wouldn't have these twists at all. And you'd just be, what you'd be doing is you'd take a function on HP, and you're making out of that that's left invariant under NP, and you're making a function that's left invariant under NP prime. Now, if you want more motivation, you could try to do the following. You could look in, he doesn't, of course, discuss these things, but in Mackey, he has Oxford notes in representation theory, and maybe he has it in other sources too. I guess Mackey was really the one that picked up the theory of induced representations from where it had been left off earlier with the theory of finite groups, and introduced it in the theory of representations of locally compact groups. But in particular, he went back to finite groups and he proved a bunch of new theorems about induced representations of finite groups. And what he does is he gives an explicit formula as an integral operator for finite groups. Well, integral being finite sums. So he gives formula for the general set of all intertwining operators, and the general intertwining operator between induced representations would find this helpful or not, but in two induced representations, let's say you've got a finite group H and you've got two subgroups, H1 and H2, each of which has a representation, row 1 and row 2, of a finite group, H. It's a more complicated formula. It's in terms of double cosets, or basically is related to double cosets of H1 and H2 in H. At one point, I convinced myself that this general formula, that these two fit formally into the picture of this, and various other things that come from work of Harish Chandra. So if you want, you could try to look it up and see, look up this general formula and try to see that these, in fact, formally at least, are the same same structure. Okay, well, that's just the formal part of Eisenstein series. Next, tomorrow, we'll sort of describe the main theorems that they satisfy.